has a screw thread in it, on it like that, that's in a nut, and then to turn it with a long lever in the nut, in the jack here, and the lever is 20 inches long, say, and you push it around this way, and that there are 10 threads to the inch on the jack. That's an inclined plane, you see, of some kind of complex inclined plane. And I'd like to know, how much force do I need here to lift 1 ton here? A ton is 2,000 pounds, say. So let's see. Suppose that I want to lift the ton 1 inch. Then I have to turn this around 10 times. So to lift 2,000 pounds by 1 inch, I have to turn this 10 times around. When it goes around once, it goes 2 pi times 20. It goes around a distance of approximately 125 inches around per turn. So I must really turn 125 inches is the distance that I go. And if I had various pulleys and so on, I would be lifting an unknown force, unknown weight, W, to balance. And so you find out what W is. It's about a pound and 0.6, according to this. Well, it came out 2 pounds last time. Oh, I see. I had 8 threads per inch. That made it easier. But anyway, with 10 threads per inch, it comes out 1.6 pounds for the push. And you see it's by the conservation of energy. To take still another example, we'll take a somewhat more complicated one. Consider the complex problems of this dopey nature, which is that you have a rod, so a bar, which is supported at one end, and it's 8 feet long. And then in the middle of the thing, at 4 feet, somebody has put a weight of 60 pounds. Or, I don't know, it's a bridge and there's a truck on it, huh? And there's another truck, it always makes it sound better when they say that. There's another truck of 100 pounds. No, there's no truck of 100 pounds. There's a Morris Mini Miner here at a distance of 2 feet from the fulcrum. We would like to know how hard do we have to pull over here in order to keep the smaller stuff from falling down, disregarding the weight of the rod. So we say, okay, we'll sort it this way. Suppose you had a pulley here and you had a weight down here hanging on the pulley. How big would the weight W have to be in order that this thing all balance? How can I figure that out? Well, I imagine that the weight falls any old distance. I picked it to make it easy for myself. I suppose that the weight went down a short distance, 4 inches. That is, I imagine that this lever would lift itself up around this fulcrum, like the dotted line here, a height here of 4 inches. How high would then the 60-pound weight lift? Well, it's easy to see because it's 4 to 8 yards. So it lifts 2 inches here, and this one is a quarter of the way, so this lifts 1 inch here. Therefore, the principle that the sum of the heights times the weights doesn't change, the change in this will be zero. In other words, the weight times 4 inches down, if you like to think that way, you can put the equation any way you want, plus 60 pounds times 2 inches up, plus, that's up, 100 pounds times 1 inch, has to add up to nothing. You don't, if you do it with minus signs. Otherwise, you put ins and outs are equal. It's the same thing, of course. And so you have here 120, 220 divided by 4 is 55. You know, it looks good how fast he does arithmetic, but he's done it before and he checked the number, so I know it's good. So you find you have to have a 55-pound weight there to balance it, and thus you can work out the laws of balance, statics, of complicated bridge arrangements, and so on. This is called the principle of virtual work, because in order to do this argument, we had to imagine virtually in our imagination that it would move a little bit. Even though it's not moving, we use the motion, and we use a very small motion, because if I try to use 400 feet here, it would get a little bit confused by having gone around so many times. So we use a very tiny motion, so it's easy to figure out that smaller the more easy it is to figure out. Actually, you see, it goes in a curve, and it isn't exactly 2 inches and so on. But you take an infinitesimal distance, and that's called the principle of virtual work, which is use the principle of conservation of energy to get the laws of those systems of this kind. Now, that's not the only kind of energy, and in order to illustrate a more another type of energy. We take another form of energy. Consider a pendulum in which when you drop it down, you let go and it comes back. It lifts itself up. It lowers. And where did the energy go? I took gravitational energy. When it's down at the bottom, it hasn't got it anymore. It's lost. But nevertheless, it can climb up again. And the way it climbs up is because we must keep track of it is to say, although it's lost some gravitational energy here, it has another form. Evidently, of course, it's in motion. And it's by virtue of its motion that it's able to climb up the height again. So we have the conversion of gravitational energy into some other form when it comes to the bottom. We have to get a formula for the energy of motion. I would like to illustrate as well as I can that a weight by gravity can, even if it does interchange into motion and come back into gravity, cannot in any way increase the height in which the ball is left. In other words, this ball can't possibly come any higher than the point at which it was left. So, we have the situation that when the thing has fallen to this distance, it's lost its gravitational energy, and if the law of conservation of energy is right, there must be in some other form, and that form is motion. So we would expect, if the law of conservation of energy is right, that it doesn't make any difference what kind of a way it comes up. And you see, if you can, that even if it comes on a shorter arc, it comes to the same height as if it's left. That is, the motion is converted into the height by the pendulum. And it doesn't make any difference by what machine the motion is converted into the height, provided it's reversible. And a pendulum is nearly reversible. There's so little friction up here. So that this will go to the same height. If we had it at a different place here, of course, it's a little different, but it comes to the same height here. And the situation is here, what's it going to do if it can't quite make it? So there we are. Now when we see that when at the bottom of the swing it has less gravitational energy, it can still recover. And the energy that it has at the bottom of the swing depends on only the height that it came down, only the height that it has to recover. We illustrated by the pendulum that it doesn't make any difference by what route it recovers the height. It is able to come up to the same height. Therefore, in the motion at the bottom is a quantity of energy which permits it to rise a certain height and has nothing to do with the machinery by which it comes up or the path by which it comes up. So that we have an equivalence formula, something like that one that we wrote for the child's blocks. But we have another form to represent the energy. And it's easy to say what it is. The kinetic energy at the bottom is given by the following formula. The kinetic energy at the bottom is the weight times the height that it could go corresponding to that velocity. Well, we just said that. But what we need is the formula that tells you, given this, we want the formula in terms of the velocity. See, to every velocity that corresponds a certain height, by some rule or other, it has to do with the motions of objects. If we start something out with a certain velocity, say straight up, it'll reach a certain height. We don't know what that is yet, but it depends on the velocity. There's a formula for that. Then the formula for kinetic energy must be, if you see an object moving with velocity v, calculate the height that it could come to and multiply by the weight. That'll be correct. Now, when we learn about the laws of falling bodies, you probably know that the formula for this, the relation between the velocity and the height, is in fact that the height that it can go is the square of the velocity divided by twice a constant, which is called a gravitational constant. So with that formula for the height in terms of the velocity, we can write this thing this way, that the kinetic energy is the weight times the velocity squared over twice the gravitational constant. And so for different speed objects, we can calculate the kinetic energy, the energy of motion. And the energy of motion is nothing but the weight times the height that that motion could lift it to if it was shot straight up. Of course, it hasn't got to do with the fact that you're in a gravitational field that motion has energy. It doesn't make any difference where you got the motion from. That formula for kinetic energy is more general than the particular place, a general formula for various velocities. Both of these formulas are approximate. This because it's not right when the heights are wrong, when the heights are so high that the gravity is weakening. This because of the relativistic corrections of high speeds. But when you get the exact formula for the energy, then the law of conservation is exact. Well, we could continue this way and illustrate the existence of energy in other forms. One that's not written there is elastic energy. If I pull on this spring, I have to do some work. I could use lift weights with it. Now that I have it down, I can lift weights with it, right? So therefore, in its expanded condition, it has a possibility of doing some work. So if I just added the sums of weights times heights, it wouldn't check out. I have to add something else to account for the fact that the spring is under tension. It's in some way. I must add a term, which I should add in here, elastic energy, which is a formula for in a spring when it's stretched. How much energy is it? And so here, for instance, if I let go, then the elastic energy is converted as it passes through the middle to kinetic energy and goes back and forth into compressing the spring and elastic energy, and it's reversible back and forth between elastic and vertical motion. But and this goes on and on, so that there's an exchange there between elastic energy and kinetic energy. There's also some gravitational energy going in and out, but you can do this experiment sideways if you want to. Incidentally, now it's gotten into a peculiar condition. It's not moving up and down. It's in the same position as it was before. Where's the energy that I put in? Now the energy is in rotation when it's turning. But when it's turned all the way, where is it? It's in twisted spring. So we have converted energy from vertical pull of a spring to vertical motion to rotational twist of a spring, and so on back and forth. It keeps going until the losses destroy it. Now come the losses. I cheated all the way through. I'm pulling little weights. I'm telling you the thing goes on forever. But in front of your eyes, you see that it's stopping. Where's the energy when it's all finished moving up and down? In other words, I have the sums of the weights and everything else. What happened? What happens in all these circumstances is this, that inside the springs, the things are made out of lots of atoms. And although with great care in the delicacy of the arrangement of the parts, you can make things so that as you roll something on something else, none of the atoms do any jiggling at all. You have to be very careful. Ordinarily, when you roll, because of the irregularities of the material, there's bumping and jiggling, and the atoms start to wiggle inside. So we lose track of that energy. We find the atoms are wiggling inside here now. After this is slowed down, they're jiggling in there in a random and confused manner. There's still kinetic energy, all right. There's kinetic energy, but it's not of the object. What a dream, huh? How do you know there's any kinetic energy? It turns out that with thermometers and so forth, you can find out that, in fact, it's warmer and that there really is a development of kinetic energy by a definite amount. And this form of energy we call heat energy, but we already know that this is not a new form. This is just kinetic energy of internal motion. And one of the troubles with all these experiments that we do with matter on a large scale is that we can't really demonstrate the conservation of energy. We can't really make our reversible machines, because every time we move a large clump of stuff, the atoms do not remain absolutely undisturbed, and so a certain amount of random motion goes into the atomic system inside. And we can't see that, but we could measure that with thermometers and so forth in the form of heat energy. There are lots of other forms of energy, and of course I can't describe them any more in detail. There's electrical energy that has to do with pulling and pushing by electric charges. There's radiant energy, the energy of light, which we know is a form of electrical energy because light can be represented as wigglings of the electromagnetic field. So this thing is equivalent to this. This one is equivalent to this. There's chemical energy, the energy which we call the energy which is released in a chemical reaction. Actually, elastic energy is to a certain extent something like chemical energy, because chemical energy is the energy of attraction of the atoms one for the other. And so is the elastic energy. So both the elastic energy and the chemical energy are forces of the atom. Why do I cross them out? Because our modern understanding of these is the following, that this chemical energy has two parts. Kinetic energy of the electrons inside the atom, so part of it is kinetic, and electrical energy of interaction of the electrons and the protons, and the rest of it, therefore, is electrical. So with electrical and kinetic, we have an understanding of these other forms. Next, we come to nuclear energy, the energy which is involved in the arrangement of the atoms, the particles inside the nucleus, and we have formulas for that. But we do not have the fundamental laws. We know that it's not electrical and it's not gravitational and it's not purely kinetic. So we don't know what it is, so there's an additional form of energy here. Finally, associated with the relativity theory, there is a modification of the laws of kinetic energy, or however you want to call it, so that this is combined with another thing called mass energy. It turns out that an object has energy from its sheer existence. If I have a positron and an electron that are standing still, that are doing nothing, never mind gravity, never mind anything, they come together and disappear, energy, radiant energy will be liberated in a definite amount. And the amount can be calculated from only knowing the mass of the object. It doesn't depend on what it is. We make these two things disappear and we get a certain amount of energy. When a mass is m, mass is weight divided by g, by the way, so if you like, this is mass times velocity squared over 2. This is the way to remember it. It's much better because it has nothing to do with the gravity that way. Then the formula here is mass times the speed of light squared is the energy associated with the mass. Now there's a couple of things to say about the laws of conservation of energy. In the first place, I think it's obvious from my explanations that the law of conservation is enormously useful in making analysis, as we illustrate in a few examples without knowing all those formulas. But if you had all the formulas for everything else, you can figure out an awful lot of things, how everything, lots of things should work without looking at the details. Therefore, conservation laws are very, very interesting. The question is, what other conservation laws are there in physics? There are two other conservation laws which are exactly the same as the analogous to the conservation of energy. One is called the conservation of momentum, and the other is called the conservation of angular momentum, and we'll find out more about those later. Deeply, we do not understand the conservation of energy. I mean, in the last analysis, we do not understand the conservation of energy. We do not understand energy as a certain number of little blobs. You may have heard that photons come out in blobs and that the energy of a photon is Planck's constant times the frequency. That's true, but since the frequency of light can be anything, there's no law that says that a blob of energy has to be a certain definite amount, not like the blocks of Dennis. But there can be any amount of energy, at least at present understood. So we don't understand this energy as counting something at the moment, but just as a mathematical quantity, which is in an abstract and rather peculiar circumstance. In quantum mechanics, it turns out that the conservation of energy is very closely related to another important property of the world, and that is the condition, this, that things do not depend on the absolute time. That if you set up an experiment at a given moment and try it out and then do the same experiment at a later moment, it will behave in exactly the same way. Whether this is true or not, we don't know. But if we assume that this is true and add the principles of quantum mechanics, then we can deduce the principle of the conservation of energy. It's a rather subtle and an interesting thing, but it's not easy to explain at all. Now, the other two conservation laws then are all linked together. The conservation of momentum is associated in quantum mechanics with this proposition, that it doesn't make any difference where you do the experiment. If you move the apparatus over to one side, it'll do exactly the same thing. So the independence in space has to do with the conservation of momentum. Independence of time, so I always think of time as the fourth dimension, has to do with energy. And finally, if you turn your apparatus, it doesn't make any difference. And so the invariance of the world under rotation is related to the conservation of angular momentum. Beside that, there are three other conservation laws. I'm giving only the conservation laws which are known to be exact as far as we can tell today. There are three other conservation laws which are much simpler to understand because they are in the nature of counting blocks. The first is the conservation of charge. And that means merely that you count how many positive and negative electrical charges you have, and the number is never changed. You may get rid of a positive with a negative, but you don't create any net number of positives or negatives. Then there are two more that are analogous to that. One is called the conservation of baryons. There are a number of particles, strange particles, a neutron and a proton are two examples, which are called baryons. And then any reaction whatever in nature so far, if you count how many baryons there are coming into a process, the number of baryons which come out is exactly the same. Finally, there's another thing, a conservation of leptons. There's another group of particles called leptons. I can count those. I can say what those are. Electron, mu meson, and neutrino. There's an anti-electron, which is a positron. That's minus one lepton. An antiparticle is minus one. So counting the total number of leptons in a reaction, you'll find that the number in and the number out also never change. That at least is as far as we know today. Those are the six conservation laws then. Three of them subtle, involving space in the form of... three of them simple in the sense of counting something. Now, with regard to the conservation of energy, there are one or two remarks I would make. First, that energy, available energy, is another matter. There is a lot of jiggling around of the atoms of in the water of the sea. And so this, because the sea has a certain temperature, but it is impossible to get them herded into a definite motion without taking energy from somewhere else. That is, although from a fact energy is conserved, the available energy to human utility is not conserved so easily. And although there's energy in the sea, you can't get it out directly. The laws which govern how much energy is available are called the laws of thermodynamics and involve a concept of entropy, or irreversible thermodynamic processes. You see, the disorder which has been created, the jiggling which has been created in here now, is very hard to say with magic. Every atom shall turn around and the whole darn thing should go backwards until gradually this motion reverses and I get back my kinetic energy. It's very hard to do. In fact, impossible in practice. Although the energy is there, we can't get it out anymore. It has become... It's like if you mined iron and collected it into a pile and then let the rain run and it went into rust and it got dissolved in the whole earth, all right. Then in order to collect it all back together again, it takes a lot of effort. And it's that kind of a loss of energy. Although the energy is not lost physically, it's lost from a practical point of view. Finally, let me remark on the question, where can we get energy? Our supplies of energy today are all from the sun, rain, coal, uranium, and hydrogen. The sun makes the rain, of course, and the coal also, so that all those are from the sun. Although energy is conserved, nature doesn't seem to be interested in it. She liberates an awful lot of energy from the sun, but only one part in 2 billion falls on the earth. So that nature has conservation of energy, but doesn't really care. She spends a lot of it in all directions. In the future, we expect to get energy. We have already gotten energy from uranium. We can also get energy from hydrogen, but it's now only an explosive and dangerous condition. If it can be controlled in thermonuclear reaction, then it turns out that the energy could be obtained from a quart of water a second is equal to all the electrical power generated in the United States. So with a faucet running 15 gallons of water a minute, you have the fuel to supply all the energy in the United States that's used today. Therefore, it's up to the physicists to figure out how to liberate us from the need for having energy. And it can be done in practice. Thank you. Dangerous game.
This lecture, The Theory of Gravitation, was presented by Dr. Richard Feynman on October 17, 1961, at the California Institute of Technology.
I have the privilege of calling your attention today to what is probably one of the most far-reaching generalizations of the human mind. And while we're admiring the human mind, which is something we enjoy doing, it's always somebody else's human mind that we enjoy admiring. We should take some time off to stand in awe of nature, of a nature which can follow with such completeness and generality such an elegantly simple principle as the law of gravitation. And what is this law of gravitation? It is that every object in the universe attracts every other with a force proportional to the mass of each and varying inversely as the square of the distance between them. If you like mathematics, you can write that same thing as an equation. Proportional to the mass of each and inversely as the square of the distance between them times some constant. Now, if I add to this the fact that an object responds to a force by accelerating in a direction of the force to a degree inversely proportional to the mass of the object, I will have said everything. And were you sufficiently talented mathematicians, then you could figure out all the consequences of this. But since you're not sufficiently talented, as a matter of fact, that's the purpose of this series of lectures, is to develop your talents in this direction. I'll have to tell you about it in more detail than just to leave you with those two principles and let you calculate everything. So if you'll permit me, I'd like to tell you not only some of the consequences, but also a story some of the story of the discovery of that law, its effect on history, the mysteries that such a law entails, refinements of the law made by Einstein, and questions of its relationships to the laws of physics, the other laws of physics. I can't do it all in this lecture, but I intend to do it ultimately by the time we're finished with our series of lectures. But we'll see how we do some of it today. First, it all began by the ancients observing the motions of the planets around the stars, mostly the planets, and finally deducing that they went around the sun, a discovery which was later made again by Copernicus. Exactly how they went around the sun and exactly what motion took a little more doing, and there were great debates as to whether they really went around the sun or not in the beginning of the 15th century. But Tycho Brahe had an idea which was different than anything that the Greeks had, and which is following, that these debates about the motions and the meaning of the motions of the planet could best be resolved if we would measure where they really were sufficiently accurately. That if we knew exactly how they move by measurement, then maybe we could decide against one or another viewpoint. This is a tremendous idea that you should do some careful experiments instead of deep philosophical arguments and find something out. So as a result of this, for many years, he studied in his laboratory, in his observatory on an island whose name was very good, but I can't remember at the moment, the positions of the planets, and made great tables, which were then studied by the mathematician Kepler. And he discovered from the data that there were some very remarkable, beautiful, and simple laws that the planets obeyed. First of all, they went around the sun in a shape, a curve called an ellipse. That doesn't just mean an oval. It's a very specific and precise curve, the one you get by taking two tacks and a string, or more mathematical, the locus of all points, the sum of whose distances from two fixed points are a constant. Or, if you will, a circle foreshortened is an ellipse. That was the first observation. The second one was that the planets do not go around at a uniform speed, but when they're nearer the sun, they move faster, and when they're further from the sun, slower. In what way? In precisely this way. That if you look at the planet at two successive times, let's say a week apart, and draw the two lines from the sun that encloses a certain area, if you did it in another part of the orbit here, where it's further away, the area enclosed in the same length of time, day a week, would be the same. So we say equal areas are swept out by the radius vector in equal times, and that determines the speed around the orbit. Finally, there's a third law, which was discovered by him much later, which is of a different category than the other two, because this doesn't deal with a single planet like these, but relates one planet to another. And it says that if you compare two planets which have different orbits of different sizes, and measure the size by what is technically called the semi-major axis, which is just a half of this distance across here, that the length of time the planet takes to go around it as complete cycle varies as a three-halves power of the semi-major axis. So to make it simpler, if the planets went in circles, and they nearly do, then the time it takes to go around would be proportional to the radius of the circle to the three-halves power. But it's a little more complicated when it's an ellipse. Well, while Kepler was discovering these laws a little bit later, Galileo was studying the motion of matter. You see, the problem is, of course, even if you know this, what makes them go around? And in those days, one of the possible theories that were proposed was that what made the planets go around was that they were behind them here located invisible angels which are beating their wings and driving the thing forward. As you'll see that this theory is now modified. It turns out that in order to keep them going around, you need the invisible angels to be flying in this direction and to have no wings. Otherwise, it's a somewhat similar theory. Now, Galileo discovered a very remarkable fact about motion, which was essential in order to understand the reason for these laws. And that is the principle of inertia, which is this, that if you have something moving and a unit just going along and nothing touching it, just not disturbed in any way whatever, Galileo realized by some experiments and generalizations and idealizations that he proposed that it would go on forever, coasting at a uniform speed in a straight line. In other words, if nothing disturbs an object, it'll keep on coasting at a uniform velocity in a straight line. Why does it keep on coasting? Maybe it's the angels, but we don't know. But at any rate, that's the way it is, that unless this, then Newton modified this idea and said even more, that if you want to change the motion, you do it by a force. If you want to speed it up, then if it sees it or it gets speeded up, when a force is applied in a direction of motion, it gets its speeds changed into a new direction if a force is applied sideways and it's deviated sideways. So Newton added the idea that you need a force in order to accelerate, that is to change the speed or the direction of the speed. You need either to accelerate it or to deviate it from the straight line motion. So as, for example, if you have a stone whirling around in a circle, it takes a force to keep it in the circle. Then you have to pull on the string. In fact, the law is that the force, that the acceleration produced by a force is inversely as the mass. The heavier it is, or the force is the mass times the acceleration. So the more massive a thing is, the stronger the force. You can measure the mass by putting other stones on the end of the same string and making it go around the same circle in the same speed. Then you'll find you need more or less force, and the amount of force is a measure of the mass. A more massive object takes more force. Now, the brilliant idea that is the result of all this is that the force needed to keep the planets in their orbits. Let me take a circular orbit for a moment. It's a little easier, but it's just as true. If this is the sun, we forget about the ellipsis, some kind of a circle. That the force is not needed to make it go this way, tangential. The angels don't have to fly that way, because that way it would coast anyway. But if there were nothing here at all disturbing, it would go off in a straight line. But the direction of the deviation of the actual motion from the line that it would have gone if there were no force is then, as you see, this way, at right angles to the motion, not in a direction of motion. In other words, on account of the principle of inertia, the forces needed to drive the planets around the sun, or to control them, is not a force around the sun, but a force toward the sun. Well, when there's a force toward the sun, then the sun might be the angel, of course, and they get a better chance at understanding everything. In other words, by having understood more about the theory of motion, it was appreciated that the sun could be the seat of the organization of the forces which governs the motion of the planets. This was Newton's discovery. And now Newton proved to himself, and perhaps we'll be able to prove it soon, that the very fact that equal areas are swept out in equal times is a precise signpost of the proposition that all of the deviations are precisely radial. That this is just a direct consequence of the idea that all the forces are directed exactly toward the sun. If there were any other components in the directions other than toward the sun, this wouldn't be true. So he realized, after guessing, that this proposition of Kepler's could be summarized by saying all forces are toward the sun. And next, by looking at this one, it is possible to show, by analyzing this one, that the forces are weaker the further away you are. If you compare two planets at different distances, that the one that's further out is weaker, and you can chase through from this one and discover that the force goes down inversely as the square of the distance. That means if another planet is three times as far away, the force exerted on it by the sun is 1/9 as much. So with a combination of these two, he concluded that there would be a force inversely as the square of the distance and directed in the line between the two objects. Being a man of considerable feeling for generality, he supposed, of course, that this wasn't only the sun holding the planets, but since it was already known, for instance, that the moons of Jupiter went around Jupiter, undoubtedly Jupiter is exerting a force on its moons, and the moon of the Earth goes around the Earth, so there's a force holding the moon from the Earth, and he already knew of a force holding us on the Earth. And so he proposed that this is a universal force, that everything pulls everything else. And furthermore, the next problem was whether the pull of us on the Earth is the same as the pull on the moon inversely as the square of the distance. An object on the surface of the Earth falls 16 feet in the first second, in 1 second, if you let it from rest. And the moon falls how far? Well, since we know if the Earth is here, you say the moon doesn't fall at all. That's a very interesting point. If the moon had no force on it, it would go off in a straight line. Instead, it goes in a circle. And so it falls away from where it would have been if there weren't any forces at all. Now you can figure out from the radius of the moon's orbit, which is something like 240,000 miles, and how long it takes to go around, which is 29-something days, how far the moon moves across this way in 1 second, and then calculate how far is this fall in 1 second. So you can figure this out by knowledge of the moon's orbit and its distance. It turns out to be roughly, I haven't figured exactly, but a 20th of a second. A 20th of an inch, excuse me. It falls a 20th of an inch in a second. Now, you see, that fits very well with this, because the Earth's radius is 4,000 miles, and something which is 4,000 miles from the center of the Earth falls 16 feet in a second. Something which is 240,000 miles, which is 60 times as far, should fall 3,600 times less than 16 feet. And that's roughly a 20th of a second. Now, it's not a question of roughly, of course. I can't make the numbers roughly here. But Newton made them very carefully, and it didn't work. And for 5 years, he didn't publish his results until he read that the astronomers had remeasured the distance of the moon or something, and they had had an error in it, and when he put the new figures in, it worked. This is the beginning of a long history in which astronomers have produced data which have confounded the other sciences for a long time until the data changed. Now, this business about the moon falling is sufficiently interesting and rather confusing, because you say it doesn't come any closer, but it falls in the sense that it falls away from a straight line, which it would pursue if there were no forces, is interesting enough that I would like to explain it once again. This time, however, I'll use the Earth. An object on the Earth's surface will fall down 16 feet in the first second. If you shoot an object out horizontally, it will go off and will fall 16 feet also, so that even though it's moving horizontally, it still comes down and falls the same 16 feet in the same time. There's a little gadget to demonstrate this. We have here a ball which is going to be driven forwards, and a ball which is just going to fall. And there's an electrical switch, so the moment this ball leaves here, this ball is released. And so this falls directly, and the other one falls so. And the point is that they come to the same depth at the same time, witnessed by the fact that they collide, hopefully. They collide in midair. And so, you see, they fall the same distance in spite of the horizontal motion. So granting for a moment that this is true, an object sent horizontally, like a bullet, will go off, and at 1 second it might go a long way, like 1,000 feet. But it'll still go down 16 feet if it's aimed exactly straight. Well, what happens if we shoot a bullet faster and faster? Don't forget that the Earth's surface is curved. So if you can shoot it fast enough, you get so that if you went off here one so fast that when it fell the 16, this is 1 second, y'all, that when it fell the 16 feet, well, let's get it right off the surface, huh? That when it fell the 16 feet, it's right at the same height above the ground as it was before. How can that be? It falls down, but the Earth curves away, so it falls around the curve, huh? So that the question is, how far does it have to go in 1 second so that the Earth is 16 feet below the horizon? If this is 16 feet, the problem is, and that corresponds to a 1 second flight, I have to shoot this thing off here so fast that this is 16 feet above the horizon. This is an Earth of 4,000 mile radius, and it sounds like a complicated thing, and it is fairly mess to figure out. But if you remember one of those wonderful theorems which you can never remember in geometry, the tangent to a curve is the mean proportional between the outside section and the inside. Now, this is 8,000 miles, roughly, and this is 16 feet. So the distance from here to here is the mean proportional between 16 feet and 8,000 miles, which is then taking a square root of something, comes out very close to 5 miles. So therefore, we know that the thing must move at 5 miles a second and then will continuously fall toward the Earth with the same 16 feet per second all the time, but will never get any closer because the Earth keeps falling away from it. Because when it gets here, it's in the same condition as it was over here, and it keeps on going around, and that's the way Mr. Gagarin has managed to maintain himself in the air and going around the Earth. Roughly 5 miles a second for 25,000 mile circumference is 5,000 seconds or 83 minutes. He He goes a little longer because he's a little bit higher. And if you figure it for a slightly bigger than 8,000-mile radius and correct the 16 feet by the inverse square, it gets weaker as you go out. Well, you'll get the right answer for any other height, including the moon, which came out to be a 20th of an inch fall. Well, with any great discovery of new law, it's useful only if it takes more out than you put in. Newton took this out. You see, he used this to find out it was radium. So he can't say, "Hi, hi, wonderful conclusion, I can prove this." He used this, essentially, or this one, to find out it was inverse square. What did he predict? First, this business with the moon was a prediction because it connected the falling on the Earth's surface to the moving to the moon. Second, the question is it an ellipse? In order to analyze the exact curve and the balance of the forces as it moves around, coasting this way and accelerating in, it makes some kind of a curve, and it's possible to calculate this motion exactly and prove indeed that it should be an ellipse, so that no extra fact is needed to explain the third law, which is a powerful prediction. But the predictions go on and on. This is very tremendous. This is a remarkable law, a very successful one. New things can be understood. For example, the pull of the moon on the Earth makes the tides hitherto mysterious. See, the moon pulls the water up under it and makes the tides. People had thought of that before, but they weren't as clever as Newton. And so they thought there would all be only one tide during the day. Because here's the Earth, you see, and here's the moon. And the moon will pull the water up under it, making a high tide and a low tide. And the Earth spins, of course, underneath that and makes the tides at one station go up and down in 24 hours. But actually, the tide goes up and down in 12 hours. And furthermore, there was some kind of considerable debate. There was another school of thought that claimed that the tide should be a big bump on the other side of the Earth, because they argued like this. You see, the moon pulls the Earth, does it not? So it pulls the Earth away from the water and leaves the So one of these are wrong. In fact, both are wrong. It works like this. The actual distribution of the tidal water is a bump on both sides. And the reason is this, that the pull of the moon for the Earth and for the water is balanced at the center. They're the same. But the water which is closer to the moon here is pulled more than the average, and the water on the outside is pulled less than the average. So it's a combination of these two pictures. But what do you mean balanced? What balances? The moon pulls the whole Earth. How can it then? Why is it the Earth doesn't fall right up to the moon? I mean, we talked about the moon being pulled by the Earth, but now I'm talking the other way. The Earth is being pulled by the moon. So why doesn't the Earth fall into the moon? Because it does the same trick. It goes around in a circle, around a point, which actually is inside the Earth, I think, but I'll draw it out here. The Earth and the moon don't, the moon doesn't just go around the Earth. The Earth and the moon both go around the central position. That this is really falling toward this position, and this is falling toward this position, and this motion around here is what balances the force. It's always falling also. It's going in a circle, too. It's not going in a straight line. It's falling toward the moon. But it does that by going in a circle, like so. So the water on the outside is thrown out more by the centrifugal force than the average or the center of the Earth, which is just balanced by the moon's attraction. The moon's attraction out here is weaker, and the centrifugal force is stronger. And that result is the imbalances in this direction on the water here. On the inside, the attraction from the moon is stronger, and because of the radius vector shorter, the centrifugal force is also weaker, and the imbalance is in this direction. So the net result is to bulge the tides on each side, and you get two tides. Nobody noticed that before Newton, because you had to understand inertia in order to understand that. What else can you understand when you understand gravity? Everybody knows the Earth is round. Why is the Earth round? Oh, that's easy. Because of gravitation. If the Earth were cubical, the corners would be so high up that the weight of the corners would just squash it down. In fact, then the Earth can be understood as being round merely because everything attracts everything else, and so it's attracted itself down as far as it can go. You can go even further. The Earth is not exactly a sphere because, of course, it's rotating, and because of these effects that we talked about from going in a curve, there's a certain outward pull, and that the gravity is effectively weakened on account of that. And so it turns that the Earth should be elliptical, and you can get the right shape of the ellipse even. So why the sun and the moon and the Earth are spheres is now deduced from the laws of gravitation. Let us go on with the law. What else can you do? If you look at the moons of Jupiter, You can get everything right the way they move around. Incidentally, there had been a certain difficulty with the moons of Jupiter, so it's worth remarking on it. When they were studied for a while, very carefully by Roemer, it was noticed that the moons in going around Jupiter sometimes seemed to get ahead of schedule and sometimes behind. You see, you can get schedule by what schedule is by waiting a very long time and finding out how long it takes on the average for the moon to go around. It turned out they didn't go around very steadily. Sometimes you'd find that the moons were ahead of where they ought to be and other times behind on the average. They were ahead when Jupiter was particularly close to the Earth, and they were behind when Jupiter was further from the Earth. This would be a very difficult thing to explain according to the laws of gravitation. It would have been, in fact, the death of the theory of gravitation if there were no other explanation, because if it doesn't work in one place, it's just wrong. And the answer to this was very simple and beautiful. It takes us a little while to see the moons of Jupiter because of the time it takes light to travel from Jupiter to the Earth. And when Jupiter's closer to the Earth, that time is a little bit less than. When it's further from the Earth, it's more. And so the moons would look like they're a little bit ahead on the average and a little bit behind on the average, depending upon whether you're closer or further from the Earth. And that was the first estimate of the speed of light, or any phenomenon that determined that light did not travel instantaneously. If you want to memorize something, 1656. Now you have to answer that on an examination. Next! Next! No, that's, I'm just, you know, that's a lot of... Next, is this. If all the planets push and pull on each other, then the force which controls, let's say, Jupiter in going around the sun is not just the force from the sun, but there's also a pull, say, from Saturn. There's not as strong, the sun is so much more massive than Saturn, but after all, there's some pull from Saturn, so the orbit of Jupiter should not be a perfect ellipse in doing all this. And if it isn't, it isn't. It's slightly off. It wobbles around the correct orbit. Like they say in the newspapers, it gets out of orbit, whatever that means. Anyway, it moves around, but it's not the only force from the sun, so it's a little more complicated motion. And so people start to analyze this motion of Jupiter, Saturn, and the third planet, Uranus, and worked out the solution of the effects of each of these planets on each other to see whether or not the tiniest deviations and irregularities in these motions could be completely understood from this one law. Lo and behold, for Jupiter and Saturn, all is well. But Uranus is weird. It behaved in a very peculiar manner, and it did not obey the correct... It did not find... At first, it was not in an ellipse, exactly. But that we understand because of the force of Jupiter and Saturn. When you took account of all the forces from Jupiter and Saturn, it still wasn't going right. And so the new law of the gravitation, new by this time a few hundred years, was in danger of being overturned, which, of course, is always possible. But two people independently, Adams and Lavoisier or somebody, Le Verrier. At any rate, these two guys independently in different places got another possible idea. Maybe there's another planet, a dark and invisible one that has not yet been seen, marked N, which could pull on the Uranus. And so they tried to figure out where such a planet would have to be in order to make the observed perturbations, and then sent messages to the respective observatories and said, gentlemen, turn your telescope in such and such a place and you shall see a new planet. Well, it depends whether who you're working with, you know, whether they pay any attention to you or not. So Le Verrier, I believe, was the one they paid attention to. Well, the other, I don't know which way it was, which was which. But anyway, one of them looked and the other one didn't. And there it was. And then, of course, the other observatory looked very quickly in the next few days. Well, that shows that the Newton's laws are absolutely right in the solar system. The question is, do they extend beyond the small distances of the nearest planet? And the first test of this is in the question of, do stars attract each other as well as the stars attract the planets? And we have definite evidence that they do in the double stars, of which we have some slides. Here's a picture of, I hope, if it's slide one, and I remember what slide one is. I can't see it. Good. Now I can't find the pointer. Okay. Turn it out again. This is a double star. See, two stars very close together. This is a third star that's put in the picture, so you know that I just didn't turn the photograph. And here's the same pair of stars several years later. The dates aren't here. I don't know what. So many years later, you see relative to this star that the axis of the pair has rotated and that the two stars are going around each other. And do they go according to Newton's laws? Well, careful measurement of the position of such a pair of double stars is shown in the next slide. And there you see the gorgeous ellipse, measured starting in 1862 and going all around to 1904. The astronomer, by this time, the thing has gone around also once more, but I couldn't find a slide for the last 60 years. Anyhow, you see it's an ellipse, all right. Everything's okay according to Newton's laws. Fits fine, except the other star isn't at the focus. Why isn't the other star at the focus? Because the plane of the ellipse isn't flat on. We wouldn't be that lucky that it's moving, that we're at right angles to the plane. But this ellipse is at a tilt. And it's a funny thing about an ellipse. If you take an ellipse and tilt it and look at it, it's still an ellipse. But the focus is no longer at the old focus. So it's okay. So you see, we can analyze the stars, one star moving about the other, showing that the gravitational laws extend over even among the stars on big distances. Even bigger distances is indicated in the next slide. If you can't see gravitation acting here, you have no soul. This is one of the most beautiful things in the sky, is a globular cluster. All these are stars. They look like they're packed solid there, but that's just because of our bad eyes or telescope. Actually, the distances between them are very, very great, and even in this region here, so that they're just like little molecules of a gas just running around, and they very rarely collide. But there are many more in the interior, and further out we get less and less. This star, for example, perhaps is falling in, will shoot through and be deviated and go back and forth, and it's obvious that there's an attraction among those stars. So it's clear that gravitation exists at these enormous dimensions, which is now perhaps, I don't know the dimensions exactly, but perhaps, at least 100,000 times the size of your solar system. Let's go further and look at the entire galaxy. The shape of this galaxy is obvious. There's a tendency to agglomerate. I'm not trying to prove that the law is inverse square, but only that there's still an attraction at this enormous dimension that holds this whole thing together. You say, that's very clever, but why isn't it just a ball? Because it's spinning, it has angular momentum, which it can't give up. And as it contracts, it has to contract mostly in a plane if it's turning. Incidentally, if you want a good problem, the exact details of how the arms are formed and what determines the shapes of these galaxies has still not been worked out in detail. So there's a good one that hasn't been thoroughly analyzed. Although it's clear it's due to gravitation, the complications of its analysis have not yet let it be analyzed. But that's now we have a scale in which this distance is perhaps 80,000, 50 to 100,000 light years. The Earth's distance from the sun is 8 1/3 light minutes. So you see, we've gotten gravity on even bigger dimensions. But gravity appears to exist on even bigger dimensions, as indicated by the next slide, which shows these little things. First, from a greater distance, you see here's one, here's one, here's one. This is a cluster of galaxies, just like the star cluster, in which all the stars were lumped together in that star cluster. So these galaxies attract each other from one to the next at such enormous distances that they are agglomerated into clusters too. So apparently the gravitation exists over distances, perhaps several tens of millions of light years. As far as we know, so far the gravity seems to go out forever. Inversely is the square of the distance as far as we know. Not only can we understand the nebulae, but we can even get some idea from the ideas of gravitation as the origin of the stars. If you had a big cloud of dust and gas, as indicated in the next slide, the gravitational attractions of the pieces of the dust for one another might make them form little lumps. You can't, unfortunately, as they always say, unfortunately, you can't see it on the slide. But I could see it when I was looking at the slide. There are little black spots in here, which doesn't show up. Maybe if you turned out the light. Not so good. There are little black blobs, which are the beginnings of accumulations of the gas due to gravitation to begin to form stars. Whether we've ever seen a star form or not is still debated. The next slide is the one piece of evidence that suggests that we have. Here's a picture taken in 1947 of a region of gas with some stars in it. And here's some, only 7 years later, two new bright spots. So the idea is that what happened is that the gas has accumulated, gravity has acted hard enough and collected into a ball
big enough that the nuclear reaction starts in the interior and turns on the star as a lit thing instead of a dark thing. This is probably a fake. It's unreasonable that in only 7 years we should be so lucky as to see the star form and change itself so much from here to here. So I believe that this is still a big mystery, and although it's usually shown as a slide representing the formation of a star, it's highly debatable. Can I have the lights and find out where I am, please? That shows us that the gravitation extends over enormous distances. But if there is a force between any pair of objects, we ought to be able to measure the force between our own objects. Instead of having to stand around and watch the stars go around each other, why can't we take a ball of lead and a marble and watch the marble go toward the ball of lead? Or watch me lean toward you. That's easy to imitate. Of course, with a Senko apparatus, we could probably do it. They apparently have an apparatus for every physical fact, which puts them in a financial position, which is very good, because there are a lot of physical facts. At any rate, the difficulty with this experiment to be done in such a simple manner is the very weakness of the force, the very great delicacy of the force. So it has to be done with extreme care and so forth, and nobody blowing on the ball and so on. And this means covering it to keep the air out and watch out that it's not electrically charged and so on. And then it can be measured. And it was measured first by Cavendish in an apparatus which is only schematically indicated on the next slide, which demonstrated first the direct force as measured on the Earth between a ball of lead and a smaller ball of lead. What happened is he had two big ones here, and then on the end of an arm, two little ones. And this arm was supported by a very fine fiber, what we call a torsion fiber. This point is not a pivot. It's held fixed up here, so it can't turn. And in order to turn, you have to twist the fiber. And by measuring how much the fiber gets twisted, see, the fiber resists the twist a little bit. And by measuring how much it twists the fiber, you can measure the strength of the force, verify that its inverse is the square of the distance, and determine how strong it is. That is, determine exactly what the coefficient G in this formula is. You can give me back the lights, please. Thank you. That is, in this form here, how big is the G? That determines, because we have all the masses and distances known. You say, but we knew it already for the Earth. Yes, but we didn't know the mass of the Earth, or we didn't know what to put in here. But this experiment, of course, by telling us G and knowing how strong the Earth attracts these things, will tell us how heavy the mass is, indirectly, of the Earth. So this experiment for Sunday supplement has been called weighing the Earth. Cavendish claimed he was weighing the Earth. What he was measuring was the coefficient of the gravity law, and because we already knew how strong the Earth attracts things, we could determine how heavy the Earth was. And that's the first time that the mass of the Earth is determined. In fact, the only way by which the mass of the Earth is determined. It's hard to emphasize or to exaggerate the importance of this great success of the theory of gravitation had on a history of science. If you try to compare the difference between the feeling of confidence and knowledge that one has in the earlier ages where there are a lot of debates and things are confused, and to the clarity and simplicity of this fact that all the planets and the stars and so on would have such a simple rule to govern them, that they were not so mysterious after all, in at least that respect, and that nature had this simplicity. Further, that man could understand it, that we could summarize this thing in our heads and thus be able to tell how the planet should move, so to speak, or how they should. Of course, they always do what they should. But we understand the motion of the planets then. That this, of course, is the real reason why the sciences in the years following was so successful, because from that lead gave hope that the other laws, the other phenomena of the world, might also have such beautifully simple laws. Well, is this such a simple law? What about the machinery of it? After all, that's all very well. The force is inverse is the square of the distance, etc., and the acceleration goes, so it's nice. But it's mathematical. What I want to know is this. Suppose that that's the sun, here's the Earth. Now, what does the Earth do? It says to itself, let me see, how far am I from the sun? And then I take an inverse square of the distance, and that tells me how much to accelerate. In other words, no machinery is given here. All we're describing is how it moves. But we don't say how, what makes it go. Now, Newton himself made no hypotheses about how it went. He was satisfied to find out what it did without giving any machinery. No one has since given any machinery. It is characteristic of the physical laws that they have this abstract character. Just like the conservation of energy is a theorem about quantities which you have to add together without a machinery, so the great laws of mechanics are quantitative mathematical laws for which no machinery is available. Why can we use mathematics to describe nature without a mechanism behind it? Nobody knows. But we have to keep going. We find out more if we just keep going. So we keep going. However, it has been many machineries have been suggested. And just to entertain you, I will show you one which you would probably a dirty trick because you probably would think of it after a while. And then you'd be so excited and happy. I did myself think of it until I found out it was no good. And it was also discovered in 1750 some odd. However, every once in a while I get a letter from some crank who has this wonderful theory, which is the following. Suppose that there were lots of particles that were running around in space at a very high speed and that went through matter very well but were only slightly absorbed. And they would go through everything, flying in all directions. And of course, when they're absorbed, they give an impulse to the Earth. But because there is many going this way as that way, the impulse is all balanced. But when the sun is nearby, them what's coming from the sun side are partially absorbed. So fewer of them are coming from the sun than are coming from the other side, where they're not absorbed. Therefore, there's a net impulse toward the sun. And it doesn't take you very long to figure out that its inversely is the square of the distance because of the apparent amount of angle that the sun subtends as you vary the distance. So it's got an inverse square law and everything is fine. What's wrong with that machinery? Well, every one that you invent produces some new consequences which aren't true. And this particular one has the following trouble. The Earth, in moving in this direction, would impinge on more particles that are coming from this side than from the other side behind it. Because when something is moving, it impinges the things. The rain in your face is stronger than on the back of your head. So when you're running. So therefore, there would be more impulse given to the Earth in the front, the in-moving side, than the out-moving side. And so the Earth would feel a resistance to motion. It would be slowing up in the orbit. And you can figure out how long it would take to stop, and it would have stopped long ago. So it doesn't work. So that machine doesn't work. And no machinery that works, that doesn't produce more complications and more phenomena which don't exist, have ever been invented. Next, we discuss the possible relation of gravitation to other forces. There is no explanation of gravitation at the present time in terms of other forces. It's not an aspect of electricity or something like that. So we have no explanation. But there is the interesting thing that other forces and gravitation are very similar. So it's interesting to note analogs. For example, the force of electricity between two charged objects varies in, looks just like that. The force of electricity is some constant times the product of the charges. Inversely is a square of the distance and a minus sign. The force is inversely as the square of the distance, the product of the charges, but is in the opposite direction. Likes repel in electricity. Well, all right, the sign is reversed. But isn't it very remarkable that the laws have the same function of the distance? It is remarkable. So maybe it is possible that gravitation and electricity are much closer related, more closely related than we think. And many attempts have been made to unify so-called gravitation and electricity, the so-called unified field theory. There's only a very elegant attempt to put together electricity and gravitation. But the thing that's very interesting in comparing electricity and gravitation is to compare the